Futures Radio Show, sponsored by CME Group, the world's leading and most diverse futures and options exchange. CME Group's markets help individuals and businesses around the world effectively manage risk. For access to free educational tools and resources for the active individual trader, please visit activetrader.cmegroup.com.
Every day, traders and investors dive in to tackle the ever-changing markets to find opportunity. Futures Radio Show is your number one source for answers to the questions that all market participants want to ask. Veteran futures trader Anthony Crudele sits down with the most influential leaders and top traders in the industry. Now, here's your host, Anthony Crudele.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in for this episode with Jim Rogers. Remember, new shows are posted on Mondays and Thursdays. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes and YouTube. If you're enjoying the show, please leave a review on iTunes. Before I play today's interview for you, I want to give a shout out to the great sponsors of Futures Radio Show. CME Group, Trading Technologies, RJO Futures, and Top Step Trader. To learn more about these sponsors and the important things they are doing for futures traders, be sure to click on their logos on our website. Today I spoke with investor Jim Rogers. Jim and I talked about how he got started in investing, his process for developing a trade idea, what his edge is in investing, and how he sizes his positions. We discussed bubbles, collapses, and what he thinks the yield curves are signaling. He shares his thoughts on modern monetary theory and gives us insight on gold, silver, the U.S. dollar, and cryptocurrencies. Last but not least, we talked about central banks. So without further ado, let me take you right to the interview with Jim. Jim, thanks for coming on the show.
I'm delighted to be here, Anthony.
Well, Jim, you've been a trader for a long time. Take us back to the beginning. How did you get involved in trading?
Well, when I was a college senior, I was going to go to law school and medical school and business school, and I was a confused young man, like many, many college seniors. Then I had a summer job on Wall Street, and I immediately fell in love, because here was a place that would pay me to know about the world, and I could make money knowing about the world, and that had always been my passion. I didn't quite realize it had been my passion, but I almost instantly came to understand, gosh, he's going to pay, guys will pay me to do what I love to do anyway. And if I do it right, they'll pay me a lot of money. I couldn't believe it. So I didn't go to law school or business school or medical school. I went to Wall Street as soon as I could. And this was, just after my senior year in college.
Now, prior to that, did you even look at markets? Were you interested in them at all?
Anthony, I didn't know anything about Wall Street except it was in New York somewhere and that something had happened bad in 1929. I didn't know there was a difference in stocks and bonds. I just assumed they were the same thing. I had no clue about Wall Street until I actually took the job because I went and interviewed guys as part of the, you know, last senior year just to see what it was like. Interviewed companies, and the guy and I liked each other a whole lot. And he said, well, come work for us for the summer. I just went down there because I liked the guy a lot and had the summer job, and off I went.
So something I'm curious about, because I've been following you for a lot of years, and to me, you're a boots on the ground type of guy. And I've always been curious as to how you developed that process. So how did you go about developing your process and strategy for trading?
Well, I don't know about other people, but when I got there, I assumed everybody knew what they were doing. They were older, they were educated, more experienced, et cetera. And so I listened to everybody around me until I started realizing, well, wait a minute, these guys don't know what they're doing either, because they were wrong so many times. And then I realized, well, you know, I'm right more than they are in the what I think about the world. And so just the way I looked at the world was different. I knew that money was hard to get. I'd grown up in a poor part of the world. I knew that money didn't grow on trees. It didn't fall out of the sky. You had to work hard to get it. And so a lot of the stuff you hear, you realize, oh gosh, these guys are talking magic. That's not the way the real world is. I guess partly because I grew up in the real world. And I guess boots on the ground, as you said, I I realized that the real world was different from the fantasies that took place on Wall Street. And so I just kept pursuing it my way, doing research, talking to real companies about real things. And I knew that trees didn't grow to the sky and there was no magic.
I'd like to dissect your process a little bit. Talk to us about the steps that you go through in developing a macro theme and then getting to the point where you then sit down and actually start executing trades.
Well, it can come from the top down or the bottom up, micro or macro. Let's try to think of an example. Okay, I'm going to use one that was a while back, but it's to me a good one. I drove around the world on my motorcycle, as I think you know, and
yes,
entered Africa in the north and drove all through Africa, right down the heart of Africa, and survived to my delight. And then I crossed the border into a country called Botswana, down in the south, about which I knew very, very little. But I instantly noticed this is something different because, you know, the border guards were very efficient, went straight through. No asking for bribes or hassles or arguments or anything else. It just stamped the papers and off I went. And I noticed it was a real border post. It wasn't just some shanty out in the middle of nowhere. And there was no black market. I immediately realized there was no black market because the rest of Africa, when you cross the border, especially if you were a white guy, the black market instantly found you. But there was no black market in this country. And there were highways, real road signs, past real hotels, past real shops. Got to the capital, and it was a real hotel, real building, real street lights, real everything. So I knew that something, whatever this was, it was a bit different from all the other countries I had been through in Africa and Siberia and places. So I asked him if there was a stock market, and lo and behold, there was a stock market. It was a fairly new stock market. So I went down, met the people, and started doing more homework, met the guy in the government, in the finance department. It's a very small country, so they would see anybody, even some redneck on a motorcycle. So we hit it off, and I went and found the broker and opened an account and bought every stock on the stock exchange. Now, Anthony, lest you think I'm a big hitter, there were only 7 stocks listed at the time. But I realized that something was different here. And it was. I mean, I can go on and on about all the rest of it if you want. But I that's sort of a macro way it happened. I was looking around the world, looking around me. It can happen walking down the street. You can see something that makes a bell click. But I knew that there was something different here, and the macro view led to the micro view of opening an account and buying every stock on the stock exchange, which I owned for years. I owned for years, by the way.
I love that story, Jim. As a trader and someone who talks to a lot of traders on the show, one thing we talk a lot about is our edge. What is our edge? And for me, I've always felt that my edge as a short-term trader is experience and execution. I'm curious, what do you believe your edge is in trading and investing?
Well, first, you use the word trader because you are a trader and a successful trader. I don't call myself a trader. I call myself an investor. In my mind, there are guys like you who are fabulous at what you do. I used to work for a guy named Roy Neuberger. I mean, I never saw anything like it. He'd just sit down at his table or desk and read the paper and turn around to me and say, there's 100,000 shares of IBM on the floor for sale, bid 90. And I would say, how the hell did he know that? And he just, you know, he had a sixth sense. The tape would go by his desk and he would just know. And he was fantastic at it. He would buy it and sell it. And 3 minutes later, he'd sell it, or 3 days later. I mean, he was astonishing in my view. I am the world's worst at that. I am such a hopeless trader that if I ever said to you, buy something, you run for the hills. You wait sometimes a year or two. So I consider myself an investor where I buy things and I try to own them for years, preferably forever. That's my success, if I've had any. And the way I mean, I find something that's cheap, and usually if nobody's paying attention, it's cheap, like Botswana. I'd never even heard of Botswana till I crossed the border. And if it's ignored, it's cheap. But if you can find something that's cheap, where there's positive change taking place, often you make a lot of money. So that's my way of doing it. And the few times in my life that I've tried to be a trader, I've been an abysmal failure at it. So I applaud what you do. Mike Steinhardt was another guy, is another guy like that, I presume still. I mean, he was just phenomenal at buying and selling quickly. And I am just terribly hopeless at it.
Well, I want to talk about you as an investor. And you talked about that scenario where you went there and you bought those. You said there were 7 stocks that you bought.
Yes.
Talk us through an entry. Is it something that you scale into these positions? Do you get into them all at once? How do you go about getting into these investments?
Well, in Botswana, there was no such thing as buying all at once. It was the new stock market, small, et cetera. So scaled, yes, to use your term. I scaled into it. I bought it over time. I had to. And actually, in nearly everything I do it that way because I don't have confidence in my trading ability. I know that I'm no good at it. So I have learned to use a lot of limit orders. I mainly put in limit orders. I won't say mainly, I always put in, nearly always put in limit orders and wait for the market to come to me. And if it comes to me, I will either put in another limit order, higher or lower, or whatever it happens to be. Right now I'm buying a Russian stock, for instance, and that's exactly what I've been doing. I've been putting in limit orders for several, it's not that active, several days, weeks. If it goes up, I put in another limit order. If it goes down, I put in another limit order. I just put in yesterday another limit order down.
So based upon different themes or different investments that you're looking at, how are you determining how much you're going to commit to this investment? For me, I always say, I look at a specific type of trade, and there's some trades I'm going to trade bigger in and some trades I'm going to trade smaller in. How do you determine that?
I don't. I let the market determine. If I got the limit order in and I get hit, or when I get hit, then I determine whether to buy more. And this can sometimes take, like this Russian stock, it's been weeks, I guess, so far. The market tells me if that stock had, for instance, had doubled quickly, I probably wouldn't have bought anymore. But it has been making a jagged bottom. I don't know what the word is. I don't know how traders talk. It's up and down. It's been moving sideways, slightly higher over the past several weeks. So the market is telling me to continue to buy, and I continue to put in limit orders, and I'm doing it. If it had doubled, I probably would have stopped buying.
All right. Now, what about the opposite way? What if it would have been cut in half? For me as a trader, the one thing that I always have to know before I even get into a trade is, where am I wrong? Now, for you, you have this idea of an investment. What if it just starts going against you right away?
Well, that's a great question, and it always happens. I mean, not always. It's often happens to me that way. I have learned just to redouble my efforts, do more homework, am I right or not, and to keep buying. If I am. Now, I wish, and I have friends who use stop losses. I wish to God I'd use stop losses many times in my career, but I never have. And I sometimes am too stubborn and just keep doing homework and keep buying. Frequently, that turns out to be great, as you can imagine, if it goes down 50% and you continue to buy. If it goes down 50% and you continue to buy and it goes down another 50%, it might not be so much fun.
Well, let's talk about the scenario to where if it does double, you said that you would like to invest in things that you would ultimately like to keep forever, right? But we all know that at some point, everybody takes profit. That's how we make the money. Talk to us about how you eventually decide to start exiting something.
Well, if and when, and it does happen, something in the world changes, back to Botswana, for instance, I finally, several years later, there became a huge bubble in emerging markets, and it was obviously considered an emerging market. And they all just, if you could spell emerging markets, you people bought the stock and things went up a lot. So eventually, I was worried about, it must have been 2007 when I sold. I was worried about the world. I was worried about emerging markets because they were clearly turning into a bubble. And I reluctantly put in orders, limit orders, to sell all of my Botswana shares, and I did. I mean, that was 17, 16 or 17 years later, but that's how it worked.
So it sounds to me as though something has to change in your view for you then to start exiting. It's not price that gets you out.
No, it's not. It's rarely priced. It's no. It's rarely priced. In fact, and there have been times, I would go out to open an account in a country, and often they were a little surprised. And anybody would be walking in to open an account, and I wouldn't. And then the guy would say, "Okay, now we've got the account open, and you've sent us some money. What do I do next?" And I said, "All you do is you execute my orders." He said, "Do you want to know prices? Do I send you reports?" I said, "You never, ever, ever send me a price. You never send me a report. If something turns into a bubble, I sell." I mentioned before about Botswana and the emerging market bubble. So I did sell. I didn't want to, and I contemplated keeping the shares through the bubble and the collapse, but I have learned in life that you have to sell a bubble, no matter how good things might be after the bubble, because it just takes a long time for prices to recover from what happens during a bubble. No matter how good the situation is, it just takes a long time, and I have learned that.
Do you look at any charts? Do you use any technical analysis?
I don't use technical analysis. I do look at charts to know what has happened. I want to know what's happened over the past 10 or 20, and I like to look at very long-term charts, the longer the better, so I know what has happened. I mean, if I'm looking at a stock and I say, "Oh my God, the stock's doubled in the last 6 months," I mean, I want to know that. It just gives me an idea of what has been happening, and if there's something unusual, then I learn. I do my research to find out why. Why it happened, because that can teach you a lot about the situation.
Like I said, you've been investing, trading for a long period of time. I'm curious, have algorithms changed the way that you trade now?
No, I don't. I don't. I couldn't tell you. Well, I know what an algorithm is, but why would it change anything?
Well, it's just something I was curious about, as times change and we've moved more into, electronic trading, high frequency trading, algorithmic trading. I was just wondering if it had, any impact on anything that you were doing.
No, because I have a limit order in, and I usually wouldn't know about the strange movements. When the brokers would say to me, "What do I do now?" I said, "Don't ever send me prices. I don't want to know prices, because if the prices run up, I might sell. If they go down, I might panic. So I don't want to know the prices. I just want to continue to know the fundamentals. And thank you, sir, but I will do that on my own. So please don't send me anything. And I will send you orders to execute, either to buy or sell. So no, I don't. I would not be aware normally of the big changes caused by algorithms.
I see many traders and investors making decisions, investment or trade decisions, based upon things that they're seeing happening right now that are similar to what's happened in the past. Do you do that? Or do you go into every investment opportunity, like we mentioned, boots on the ground, and say, "Look, this is what's happening here right now. I just have to look forward to what could happen from here." Or are you going back and comparing similar situations?
Well, no, obviously it depends. I only invest on what I think is going forward. But I mean, it's all happened before. We've been having bubbles for hundreds of years. They all look the same, Anthony. Doesn't matter where they are, what country, what asset, you know, stocks, bonds, doesn't matter. Currencies, it doesn't matter. All bubbles look the same. The same thing happens. People say the same things. They always say it's different this time. They always say, oh, you don't understand. You know, it's always the same. And that is useful because then I know I better get out or at least avoid that market or perhaps sell that short. All bubbles look the same, and likewise, all panics. All panics look the same. You know, when there's a war or there's a civil war or something, countries get destroyed, and it always looks the same. Venezuela right now is destroyed. They've had all kinds of whatever you want to describe the war, civil war, chaos, whatever it is. It's a disaster. People are fleeing. Everything totally drops. That's the time, and they all look the same. And that's the time that you should do your homework and perhaps start buying. And so in that sense, it has all happened before, especially the extremes, you know, the bubbles and the panics. And that gives me some guidance and helps me make decisions.
Just so I'm clear on this, I think what you're saying is you're not comparing data points as to what's happening now versus the past. You're comparing the pattern that occurs when a bubble's being made.
Well, I'm not quite sure how you define pattern, but yes, it sounds like the answer is yes to that. As I said, bubbles all look the same, and if that's how you define pattern, yes. And likewise, collapses, especially collapses from war or civil war, pretty much all look the same, and the pattern is the same. And that doesn't make me invest, but it leads me to look to see what, if anything, I should do. For instance, I sold Botswana because it was clearly a bubble that was developing. And as I said, I know from my experience and reading and my own experience, I know that bubbles always end badly, no matter how sound the situation. I mean, Microsoft was in a bubble in 1999. And if you sold it, you did the right thing, even though Microsoft is still here, you know, 20 years later. It's still, and the stock is now above where it was 20 years ago, but you had a long, many-year period when the stock was down a great deal, even though it was real in the end. And by the way, most of those stocks that were in that bubble disappeared. Some survived, but most disappeared. And even the ones that survived, it took a long, long, long time for the price to come back, even though the companies were sound and continued to grow.
Are you seeing any bubbles right now?
The fangs are clearly a bubble now in the U.S. Let's see. American University Education is a bubble, but I don't know a way to short it. European football clubs, but I don't know a way to short that bubble. There's another one going on somewhere. I just don't happen to remember it at the moment. I'll probably think of it before we finish.
No worries. Feel free to bring it up anytime if you remember it. I want to talk about your current macro thoughts. I've said many times in the show so far today, you're a boots on the ground type of guy. So where have you been visiting and what are you seeing?
I did go to Venezuela because of what I saw. I mean, it's academic because I'm an American. I'm a citizen of the land of the free. We're not so free, as you may know. I mean, it's illegal for you. And if you're an American, it's illegal for us to invest in Venezuela right now. Many people are pouring in. The Venezuelans realize the opportunities. North Korea is a fabulous opportunity right now, but again, I'm a citizen of the land of the free, so there's nothing I can do about it except look and hope. In the meantime, the Russians and the Chinese are pouring in there. Eventually, you and I can invest in North Korea, and the Russians and the Chinese will be standing at the border saying, ah, hello, Mr. American. We have some special things for you. Prices will be up a lot. Cuba, same way right now. You know, a lot of people are pouring into Cuba, and someday they'll all be on the beach waiting for the Americans to show up after they've marked the prices up, et cetera, et cetera. It's sometimes tough being a citizen of the land of the free. So there are places, but let me see what's Venezuela, I definitely would love to be buying, but cannot. North Korea, I would love to buy, but cannot. I mean, there's no market in North Korea. There is in Venezuela. Zimbabwe. I bought a few shares of Zimbabwe recently, not much, just to get my to remember so that I remember Zimbabwe. That's a total, you know, 50 years ago, Zimbabwe was the richest country, one of the richest countries in the British Commonwealth. It's been totally destroyed by a crazy dictator over the next 37 years. But it's a great opportunity now, is what I'm getting at. That's all I'll think of some more. Don't worry.
Now, you said that we're citizens of the land of the free, and you're living in Singapore. Why are you choosing to live in Singapore?
Well, I live in Singapore because I want my children. The decision was made so that my children, I only had one at the time, but would know Asia and speak Mandarin, because their lifetimes, Mandarin is going to be the most, or certainly one of the most important languages in their lifetimes. And Asia, 21st century, certainly going to be the century of Asia. So I wanted to prepare them. I tried in New York. My daughter was speaking Mandarin, but I came to realize, because so many people told me, our parents did that, but by the time we were 9 years old, we hated it. We didn't want to go to language school anymore. We hated going to weekend language school, and we refused to speak it. And they would all tell me, my God, did we make mistakes? So I realized that if I was serious, I was going to have to take her someplace where she didn't have a choice. But she had to speak Mandarin. She had to know Asia. So we looked around and we wound up in Singapore.
I visited Singapore in November of last year. Beautiful place. Loved it. I came back and told my wife, I said, I could actually move to Singapore. She looked at me and I said, yeah, I'm serious. It's a beautiful country. I love it. I want to pick your brain a little bit about yield curves. Which ones do you watch? And what do you think they are forecasting for the U.S. economy?
Well, since I try to be aware of everything that's going on in the world, especially the financial world, I watch them all. I don't watch them as intensely as I used to, and certainly not as intensely as the firms do, the investment firms do, and the internet. I know what history says, that when they invert. And when they inverted, stay inverted, it usually means that a few weeks or months later, we're going to have problems. I don't see any reason that that's changed. Maybe it has. People always say it's different this time. Well, it's rarely different this time. So I'm watching, but I have not acted because of it yet. I will say, Anthony, you know, it's been over 10 years since we've had a financial problem in the U.S., and that's the longest in American history. I mean, it doesn't mean it has to end. Could go on 20 years, you know, who knows? But it is the longest bull market we've had in American history, the longest economic good times we've had in American history. So we are getting overdue for something to happen, and the yield curve may be telling us, hey, guys, it's coming again. But the yield curve also is not a short-term signal. It only says a few weeks or months later something is going to happen.
Yeah, I started off that question by asking you, which ones do you watch? And you said all of them. And the reason why I asked that is because you're seeing different things happening on different parts of the curve. And I watch the 210 a lot, and that's the one that I have been focused on and read a lot about, that if that's the one that inverts, that's the one that's the strongest indication of a recession following, and that just continues to stay flat. And then you have the 530, which is not flattening anymore, and it's starting to steepen a little bit. So I'm just curious if there's any part of the curve that you feel we should be watching versus any other part of the curve.
Interesting. I thought you meant which countries.
Yeah,
I watch the whole world. Interest everything in the whole. I try to watch the whole world. But yes, the same. What you just said. No, I watch basically. The 90-day versus the 30-year. That was traditionally where you watched the yield curve. Now, of course, you have a lot more yield curves in the past few years. No, but I try to be aware of everything. But I don't sit and watch daily, weekly, or anything, Anthony, like you do, because you're in there every day and doing things all the time. I just try to be aware of what's going on.
What are your thoughts on modern monetary theory?
Well, I mean, it's first of all, it's not modern. Mad men have been for years been saying, let's just print some money. And no, it's been disproven many, many, many times. But you always have politicians, A, who don't know history or don't care about history or think they're smarter than history. And they come up with and say, let's take the easy way. It's not new that politicians have said something like this. Go back to Italy over the past few decades, well, before the common market. You know, France, they used to do, everybody used to do this. It's never worked. If it worked, Zimbabwe, I'd be really rich buying Zimbabwe.
What do you make of the Russians and the Chinese buying a lot of gold lately?
Well, there are people in the world and have been for thousands of years who think that the gold and silver are extremely valuable and useful. It doesn't matter what I think of gold and silver. I know that history shows whenever there are problems, whenever people lose confidence in governments or in money, they turn to gold and silver. We can all sit here all day long and say, or academics can sit here and say, it's absurd. So what? That's like saying it's absurd to drink whiskey. You think people are going to stop drinking whiskey, even though over the past few thousand years we know it's bad for you, not good for you, and it will not be a good experience? You think people are going to stop drinking whiskey or wine or buying gold? No, it's human beings. So I own gold. I've owned gold for many years. I haven't bought any serious gold since 2010, but I am waiting for gold to have one final collapse, and I hope I'm smart enough to buy a lot more gold and silver when that happens, if it happens.
What's your long-term view of the U.S. dollar?
Well, the dollar has been the world's medium of exchange and reserve currency for several decades now, but that's in the process of changing too. For a variety of reasons. One, the U.S. is the largest debtor nation in the history of the world. Not the largest debtor nation in the world, Anthony, but the largest debtor nation in the history of the world. And every country that's gotten itself into this kind of situation has had a crisis or a semi-crisis, and the world moves on to another currency. So it's going to happen. There are already several countries that are unhappy with the status of the U.S. But mainly they're unhappy because if the U.S. doesn't like you, they cut off the U.S. dollars. And people say, well, what the hell kind of world is that? That some bureaucrat in Washington, D.C. can ruin my country or my company or my family. So many people are trying to come up already with a replacement for the U.S. dollar, some for economic reasons, some for geopolitical reasons. The Chinese, the Russians, the Persians, the Brazilians even, they're all trying to come up with a replacement, or at least a competitor, I should say, a competitor to the U.S. dollar. So it is happening. I own a lot of U.S. dollars at the moment. You're probably saying, well, why do you own a lot of U.S. dollars? You told me it's the largest debtor nation. You told me people are trying to get away from the dollar. I own it because whenever there's there's turmoil or a crisis, people flee to a safe haven. And the U.S. dollar, for whatever reasons, historic mainly, is considered the ultimate safe haven at the moment. So what's going to happen is in the next turmoil, next chaos, the dollar's going to go up. It's going to get overpriced. It might even turn into a bubble, depending on how bad the turmoil is, at which point I hope I'm smart enough to sell my U.S. dollars, because that bubble, if it becomes a bubble, will probably be the last gasp of the dollar, and then it will go the way to the British pound and many other currencies. I mean, the pound's still here, but it's down enormously from its all-time highs, and it doesn't have much – it has nothing like it, what the use it used to have in the world. And that will happen to the dollar someday, and probably in the next decade or so.
Do you look at cryptocurrencies at all?
Yeah, I'm aware of them. I know about them. I've never bought one or sold one. I wish I had. I wish I'd done both, bought and sold. But they're all going to disappear. They're all going to go to zero eventually. Money is going to the computer. Anthony, money's going. I was in Beijing recently, and I tried to buy an ice cream. Poor woman couldn't sell me an ice cream because I had money. I had renminbi, but she could only take money on the phone. I don't know if you know, but in many countries, all the money's on the phone. You punch your phone on her phone or her spot, and boop, suddenly she has your money and you have her ice cream. In the end, I have it now, but I didn't have it then. She literally could not take money. And so she gave me the ice cream in the end because she felt so sorry for this poor foreigner. I wish I'd been buying a Mercedes or something of great value. But it's already happening. I mean, you can't even take a taxi in China without having internet money. So, no, it's already happened. Many countries are far ahead of the U.S. in many things electronic. So it's happening, but it's going to be government money. Anthony, 100 years ago, you and I could have used anything for money, seashells, gold. Banks could print their own money if they wanted to, and people could use anything they wanted. But in the 1930s, the Bank of England, which was the most important bank at the time, central bank, said from now on it is an act of treason to use anything for money except our money. Well, as you know, Anthony, an act of treason means they execute you. So needless to say, people stopped using seashells and sugar cubes and cattle and gold and everything else as money because they didn't want to be executed. The crypto guys say, rightly, we are smarter than the government. And they are, my God, everybody's smarter than the government, especially the crypto guys. But the governments have the guns. I don't care how smart you are. If the government's got the guns, you're either going to do it that way or you're going to find some way around it. You can try the black market, et cetera, et cetera. But the governments are not going to lose control. I don't like saying this. I don't like this at all. I wish there were a way we could escape government controls. But unfortunately, it hasn't. We haven't found that way yet. So it's going to be on the computer. It's going to be on the internet. It's going to be on our phones. But it's going to be their money, not other people's money.
You mentioned central banks. What are your thoughts on what the Fed has done since 2008? And I'm curious what you think about what the Fed will be doing from here.
Well, they're curious too. They don't know what they're doing. Are you kidding? For goodness sakes, Anthony. You know, they're bureaucrats and academics. They certainly don't know what they're going to do next. What I will tell you what they're going to do next, though. They've already started. You know, when things start getting, started having problems, they panic. They try to save us all, and they will print more money or buy more bonds. In Japan, the central bank prints what they said. You know, they said we will print unlimited. That's their word, unlimited amounts of money, and they have been. And they take the unlimited amounts of money and buy stocks and bonds. I mean, it's the worst goddamn thing I've ever conceived of. 50 years ago, no central banker would have said something that out loud, even as an idea, an hypothesis. But now the central bank in Japan is very proud to tell you that's what they're doing. So it's going to happen in America, other places too. And they're going to, when things get bad, they're going to print more money. Who knows? America may start buying stocks. In Japan, they actually buy ETFs. America may do the same. They're going to do everything they can to save us. It's going to work for a while. Nice rally like the one we're having now. But eventually the market's going to say, guys, we're not going to play this game anymore. We know. We've seen this movie. We know how it ends. And that's going to be the big, huge crash, collapse, bear market, I should say.
What would be the signs that you're looking for that would start to signal to you to start shorting stocks?
Well, the signs are already there. I'm not shorting, but the signs are already there. The way it happened, the way it always happens, is it starts in a place where we're not watching. In 2007, Iceland went bankrupt. Now, but most people never heard of Iceland, much less that it could go bankrupt or even were aware. But then Ireland went bankrupt. Then Bear Stearns went bankrupt. This is all over several months. You know, then Northern Rock, the huge English bank, went bankrupt. And then all of a sudden, a few weeks later, Lehman Brothers went bankrupt. And then people said, oh, my God, there's a problem. There's something wrong here. But that was a year or two later, probably a year 18. I forget exactly, you know. And it always works that way. It starts where people are watching, and next thing you know, watching, and then it gradually works away to it makes the evening news. It makes the BBC. It makes everything. Everybody knows. So it's already started. Venezuela, Argentina, Turkey, Latvia went bankrupt. Most people never heard of Latvia. Some Indian banks are having huge problems. Indonesia, it's already happening. it's not happened enough yet that I have started selling short in any significant way, but it's already started. It's going to happen before too much longer. I think something's going to make even me start selling short before too much longer.
Well, when you start getting ready to selling short, I'm going to have you back on the show to talk to you about it. But
Wait, Anthony. I've told you I'm the single worst market timer in the world.
That's okay.
Do not base things on me.
I'll take my chances just at least hear your thoughts on as to why you're starting. But Jim, great stuff. We are not done yet. I have rapid fire questions next if you're ready for those.
Okay, we can try. Don't know if I can handle them, but let's try.
All right, everybody. Our rapid fire segment is sponsored by Trading Technologies. Access the global markets from virtually anywhere with TT. They are the world's fastest commercially available futures trading platform. And now you can trade cryptocurrency spot and derivative markets side by side. For more information, please visit TradingTechnologies.com. Jim, first question for you. What trader has influenced your life the most and why?
Trader, if you mean trader, the way my definition of trader, it doesn't have to be Roy Newberger, because I watched him in awe and I realized there were lots of people in the market who were doing things I had no clue about. So he exposed me to the whole world of trading, which I was totally unaware of. I'm not a trader and I don't follow him, but he just taught me, oh my God, look at these guys. And there are lots of them.
What was one of the hardest things for you to overcome in investing?
That I knew what I was doing. I just assumed everybody else had to know more than I did and were more competent than I was. It's only after I had some successes, and even after I had some successes, I had some failures. But eventually, I had enough self-knowledge and self-confidence to know what I was doing and to know that I could do this.
How has your investment process evolved over the years?
From incompetence to competence, back to incompetence. I mean, my point is that I don't spend nearly as much time on it as I used to. To be a successful investor, you really have to spend a lot of time, energy, devotion, et cetera. I'm doing a lot of other things now. I've moved, I'm traveling a lot all over the world, including especially in Asia and China and Russia and places. I'm doing a lot. I mean, I just had a book that was the number one bestseller in Japan. I was shocked to find out. So I'm doing a lot of other things now. And so I don't spend nearly as much time on investing as I used to.
What is one attribute that you believe every investor should have?
Independent thinking.
What's your favorite book about investing?
Well, I guess the book that I still to this day tell people to read is Security Analysis by Ben Graham. I read it decades ago, or short of that, The Intelligent Investor by Graham and Dodd. Because Ben Graham, his ideas of investing in own fundamentals and cheap stocks, I realized that's the kind of investor I was, that's what I loved and thought was great. So I get, that's the book I, when people ask me what book to read or books to read, I tell them about Ben Graham. I mean, I remember reading Adam Smith's book, The Money Game, back in the 60s, which I still tell people to read. I still tell people to read John Train's famous Financial Fiascos. I don't even think it's in print anymore, but it can be found. There's some, but what I find most useful, or did, or have, maybe not now, might be different now, is to know about the history of markets, because they're all the same. Everything has happened before. The bubble in 1999 was exactly like the previous bubbles. The bubble in 2008 was exactly like previous bubbles. The bubbles in Europe, the bubbles in the Middle East, the bubble in Japan, they're all exactly the same. So the more you know about markets, the more you know what to look for, and you may avoid some of the traps or some of the problems.
What's the best piece of advice that you received about investing?
Well, I do remember a guy once said to me, follow the money and you'll know what's really happening. He was talking about the world more than specifically investment, but that applies to investing too. See where the money's going, and you'll probably figure out how to be a good investor. And by the way, that also means see where the money is leaving, because that may give you opportunity. You know, Venezuela, I mentioned Venezuela before. All the money's getting out of Venezuela. Well, if you realize that all the money's leaving Venezuela, you may want to go in. I cannot, because it's illegal. I'm an American. But if you find a place where all the money is panicking and leaving, fleeing, it's a place that you should be looking at to see if you should be buying. So follow the money.
If you could go back in time, Jim, and give the younger you a piece of advice, what would it be?
Move to China and learn Mandarin. Well, when you say younger, let's see. In 1964, I graduated from college and I went to Oxford, because that was, you know, that was a cool thing. But that was the past. If I had been smart in 1964, I would have gone to Taiwan and learned Mandarin. I wasn't smart. I went to Oxford instead. I mean, don't get me wrong. I had a fabulous time at Oxford. I've had a fabulous life. But you said, what would I have changed? Instead of going to Oxford, I would have gone to Taiwan and learned Mandarin.
If you had an elevator pitch me your edge in investing, what would you say?
Curiosity. Independence, independent thinking.
Last question for today, Jim. What's your favorite thing to do when you're not investing?
My children. I have these two fabulous daughters that, Anthony, for decades, I never wanted children. I thought children were a horrible time, waste of time, money, energy. I felt sorry for all my friends who were such saps. They had ruined their lives by having children. I could not conceive of ever doing something so foolish. Well, I was totally wrong. I had my first child when I was 60, and it has been just bliss ever since. There's nothing I'd rather do than be with my children.
Jim, where could people find you on a website, or I know you're not on social media because I'd be following you. Where could people go to read more about you?
Well, I have published some books. I have a website, but it's really just I put my second round the world trip on the website, so the world would have a historic memory of what the world was like at the turn of the millennium. And there I do list my schedule. I make a lot of speeches, so my schedule is there if somebody happened to want to hear me speak someday. My books are there. I've done several books. I told you, I recently, some reporters came here and interviewed me from Japan. I didn't pay much attention to it. They went off and published a book, which they told me what to do, but I didn't really remember or pay much attention. They wrote me one day, a month or so ago, and said, your book's the number one bestseller in Japan, the number one bestseller of any books, any kind of books. I was stunned. I was shocked. I'd forgotten about the book. I'd completely forgotten about it. Anyway, all that stuff is on my website if anybody wants to buy that book in Japanese or any other books.
And that's just jimrogers.com?
Yeah, Jim Rogers, www.jimrogers.com.
Jim, what could I say? It was an honor to speak with you, sir. Thank you so much for coming on Futures Radio Show.
Anthony, it was my pleasure. It's always a delight for me to talk to a successful trader, much less a trader who survived. So it's great. You know, I always sort of wonder about guys like you and Mike Steinhardt and Roy Neuberger. I'm so bad at it that it's a delight to talk to people like you. Let's do it again sometime.
Thank you for listening to Futures Radio Show. If you have any questions or comments for myself or my guests, please visit futuresradioshow.com and sign up to be a premium member for free. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to leave us a review on iTunes.